Pints with a Purpose, Newcastle, May 2014, with Cap Evans.
Well, people are still streaming in through the doors. Welcome to everyone tonight for our second Pints with a Purpose for 2014. And it's fantastic to see such a fantastic lineup of people tonight. And it's just fantastic to welcome you all tonight. And so thank you very much. And I know that tonight we're going to be privileged to hear someone who we all know and love. I don't know if there'll be anyone in this room who doesn't know who Cath Evans is. And the significant role that Cath has in the story of St. Mary of the Cross MacKillop, and of course of this diocese. So I'm not going to tell you much about Cath's story because you know quite a lot of it already. But I'm looking forward to hearing from Cath, as it's always great to hear someone with such a down-to-earth, loving, wonderful spirituality, sense of humour, and of course someone who doesn't take herself too seriously. So I'll hand over to Cath now. Let's give her a round of applause as we welcome Cath Evans.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll start by standing up, but I may sit down. Okay? I'm just going to start with this prayer. Every day I need thee, Lord, but this day especially, I need some extra strength to face whatever is to be. This day, more than any day, I need to feel you near, to fortify my courage and to overcome my fear. By myself, I cannot meet the challenge of the hour. There are times when human creatures need a higher power to help them bear what must be borne. And so, dear Lord, I pray, hold on to my trembling hand and be with me today. Amen. That beautiful prayer, some people might know it, that beautiful prayer was given to me when I was very sick in the early 90s. And Barry and I were a parent couple to our youth group in the church at the time called Antioch. And one of the Antiochers and her mum gave me that beautiful prayer. And every morning we started our day off, Barry and I, by saying that prayer. So I call it a really comforting prayer. Have we got any copies of that with us or not? You'll have a look, because people usually come up and ask for some copies. Okay, thank you all for coming. It's lovely to be here with you. It's lovely to be back in town for a little while. We now live on the Central Coast, but I'm afraid Lake Macquarie will always be home to us. Barry here with me is my husband, my other half. Sometimes he's my better half, sometimes he's my worst half. Tonight he's my other half. and I have five children, with two of them are here today, and I'm going to ask them to stand up and get them really embarrassed. Annette, she's our second daughter, and Luke, he's our baby. Thank you. Yeah, so the eldest is 52 this year, and Luke is 34 this year. Oh, I'm glad I got that right. When I was sick, I had six grandchildren. Now I've got 21. And two of those 21 are great-grandchildren. So it's actually started the next generation. And I always like starting with that because I feel very blessed to have seen 15 grandchildren that I should never have seen. And I'm very close to my grandchildren, even though they're scattered around Australia. Some are in Darwin. I still keep in touch with them, so that's really lovely. A lot of people ask me, why me? Why was I the chosen one for Mary MacKillop? And it's something I can't answer really, But I'll tell you where I come from, and perhaps, you know, to me it explains why. We come from Lake Macquarie in a town called Windale. I think everybody here would know Windale. It is 97% government housing, or was in the 90s. We haven't lived there for many, many years now, about 8 or 9 years. Oh, it's longer than that, because we lived at Gateshead after. Oh, we went back to Windale, yeah. About 8 years. in the 90s, when they did the census, it was the poorest town in New South Wales. And I suppose that's, you know, why wouldn't someone be picked from a town like Windale? We feel as though we were very blessed to be in Windale, because we had a great community in Windale. We had everything that the Catholic Church could offer in our parish, and it was a great place to be sick in, because everybody pulled together and they prayed for us and they looked after us, and also with our kids. So I don't like people running down Windale, because we found it a quite warm place to live in. Back in 1992, I was diagnosed with lung cancer, and I went to quite a few doctors. My GP sent me to a few doctors. So I went to a few doctors, and I was always told that there was nothing that they could do for me. So in the end, my doctor sent me to a heart-lung specialist. And what that specialist was hoping to do was to take out my right lung, because Luke was only 13 years old at the time, and he was in year 8 at St Mary's Gateshead. And by taking that lung out, he was hoping that I would stay around for 8 to 10 years and see Luke through his final education. But when he put me into hospital and gave me a biopsy, they found that the cancer had come out of the lungs and it had gone into the glands. And one of the glands that was riddled with cancer was the gland that was close to the heart. And even though he was a heart specialist, he was very reluctant to take or touch that gland, and it really had to come out. So he decided to send me home for the weekend and be with the family. But before he sent me home, he got an x-ray taken of my head. And then he rang Barry on Monday and said, "I'm really, really sorry, but I would lose your wife on the table. I can't operate. There's been a spot found on the bottom of her brain." So that put paid to an operation, which was really hard for Barry and I, because we were hoping that I could have that and stick around for a little while. I was sent to the Mater Hospital, where I was told that chemotherapy wouldn't be any good because the cancer was too aggressive. And I could have ray treatment, and he was prepared to give me ray treatment. But all it would do would be to take or ease some of the side effects away. Now, by the time we got to the Mater Hospital, it was nearly a month, and I was getting very, very weak. And I was also told that it wouldn't take the cancer away, and if I was lucky, it may give me 2 weeks on the other end. And by this time, I was given 2 months to live. So 2 weeks on, 2 months, and having to go to the hospital for 10 days to have the treatment just wasn't on for me. So it was at that stage where I decided that I'd have no treatment. And that is where, when I'm sitting in that seat there, that is when that time was, that's around about the same time. On my knee is one of my grandsons, James. And James was about 4.5 months old there. and he used to come over with his mum every day. And as you can see, he's quite comfortable on my knee there. He didn't like to be shifted off it. And mum had to feed him and everything while he was sitting on my knee, and he even slept there. So we had a really amazing bond, James and I. And I think it was because he had just come from God and I was going to God. And our spirits connected. It's something that you have to experience to be able to explain it. Mind you, he's 21 now, and he's the same as any of the other grandkids. No different. You know, he won't give me his bed anymore when I come up and stay. And you can watch TV as long as it's his programs and not something. And 21-year-olds aren't my cup of tea. So, you know, he, even though I'm still very close to him, he isn't, that bond, that spiritual bond has long gone. I ended up, after that photo was taken, that's in our lounge room, I ended up going downhill very, very quickly in the next couple of weeks. And I got to the point where I couldn't even get out of bed. Barry had to help me, and he had to bath me, he had to even take me to the toilet, he had to do everything for me. And as far as my doctor was concerned, I was in the last stages of my life. And so it was really hard times for us. The only thing that we had left was prayer, and we did turn to prayer. Mind you, we had prayer right from the beginning, from the first day that my doctor told me that I had cancer. We left the surgery and went straight to our priest, who prayed with us and started special masses for us. And I still went down to the lowest point that I could get. And that's where Mary MacKillop came into our life. Now, I didn't know much about Mary MacKillop, and I used to feel terrible saying that, but I don't think a lot of people did know much about Mary MacKillop at the time, unless you went to a Josephite school. And all I knew was what I read about her, because she was in the news a lot at the time. She was, they were trying to get her over the line to become our first saint, and they needed miracles. So the church demands that you have two miracles, and the first miracle that's granted through the prayers of Mary MacKillop was a woman who had leukemia, and she was a young woman, and she'd just been married, and she took sick. And she was told she couldn't have any children. Then she was told she had leukemia and didn't have long to live. And they started something similar that I'll explain to you in a minute, that we did. And her leukemia disappeared. She not only had children, she had six. And the first one was born on Mary MacKillop's feast day. So that was the first miracle. So they were looking for another one. I had a friend who lived up in the coal fields, and one of my daughters, Julie, went up to see her, and when she was going, Anne said to Julie, "Oh, I'll have to give you something for Mum." And she went into her bedroom and she brought out the relic of Mary MacKillop. Now, this was in 1993, and Mary MacKillop wasn't even blessed at the time. She was just Mary MacKillop. And here's the relic here, if anyone would like to have a look at it after. It's now put in plastic because it was getting a little bit... little bit knocked around. It's been through the washing machine a couple of times. So I used to put it on my bra. And so, because people like to see it, we put it in plastic. So Anne gave Julie that relic. And she also gave Julie a novena card, which some of the young ones might know. A novena is a prayer. It can be any prayer that a group of people say for 9 days. And what they gain from that is that there's an Antiochus would know this. There's a group of people all praying at the one time. They try and do it at the same time every day, so that prayer is going up to God at the same time. Anyway, she gave me the prayer, and she asked me to hold off, or asked Julie, hold off till we get it said in Sydney. And she had a very good friend who was a Brown Josephite in Sydney. And what her friend was going to do was to have an official novena, which meant that they would start the novena and we'd all join in with them. And they would get in touch with all the Josephites, the Brown Joeys, and they would do the novena with us. So we had a group of Antiochus. There's about 60 in our group at the time, and they were great prayers, and they were from the age of 16 to 21, our group, and they joined in that novena. And all Antioch, right through Australia, prayed at 9 o'clock every Sunday night for me. So we had hundreds of people praying for us, or praying for me. And so within a couple of days of that novena, now I couldn't get out of bed, but after that novena was started, I was able to sit back out there in that chair. Now, I wasn't able to stay there for very long, but every day Barry would help me out and I'd sit in that chair. And this other photo you see there is James, the same baby on my knee, and all mums can see. There's a few weeks difference between the first picture and the second. And within a week after the novena, that's me out in the backyard. Isn't that amazing? Even, you know, when I tell this story, I still get goosebumps. When I talk about those two photos, they're so important, and we were so very, very fortunate to have them, weren't we, Annette? I say we were so very fortunate to have those two photos that that it's helped in our story right from the beginning. So, I just get goosebumps. I think it's an amazing story. Now I'm going to do something. A couple of weeks ago, about 6 weeks ago, I did a weekend down in Kincumber where we live. And I did it on Mary MacKillop. And a sister from Lochinvar came and helped me, and she did it on Tennyson Woods because the Josephites were started by Mary MacKillop and Tennyson Woods. And it was a fantastic weekend. And the difference between that weekend and ordinary ones was that 23 of the people there were deaf. And when I was talking to the two interpreters, I said, well, I like to ask questions after I finish talking. So I said, what will I do? And she said, well, what do you mean? She said, ask them questions the same, because they were sign language to them. She said, they're just ordinary people, which set me back a bit. I thought, oh, what's this weekend going to be like? But do you know what I used to have to say to them? They asked so many questions, I'd have to say, just one more, one more, because we're running out of time. So don't just sit there tonight and not ask any questions, okay? Would anyone like to ask on that sickness or something? No? Okay, I shall go on. After that all happened, I just got better and better. Barry, within a couple of weeks, Barry had got in touch with the sisters in Sydney and told them what had happened. And they got, they acknowledged him. There's no emails or anything in that time. It's 21 years ago, okay? So it was letters and phone calls. And they got back in touch with Barry and they said, you know, would you get Kat's files and get the, and print, you know, do a copy of the files and send down to us? And he said, yes, he'd do that. So he did, and they acknowledged that they got them. And we didn't hear, that was in 1994. It was 10 months since I was told I had cancer when I went back and had a test and told the cancer was all gone. Right through. I had tests. Just first it was just an x-ray and the cancer had disappeared. And then, of course, I had a test with my head and everywhere. So within a few weeks, he got in touch with them and he sent the reports down. And we didn't hear anything until 2005, which is 11 years. Didn't hear anything from anyone. Not that we never ever thought of my sickness being the miracle for Mary MacKillop. We were just letting them know that we'd had a miracle through Mary's prayers. And then one night in 1965, on the Sunday night, 2005, yes, 2005, Barry and I were watching Compass. And it was the day before Mary MacKillop's feast day. And on that Compass show was this little boy called David. And David had a tumour on the brain. And the sisters in Sydney were hoping that David would be the second miracle that would get would make Mary our first saint. But one of the things that the church stipulates is you must have your original doctor sign on a dotted line. And even though David's doctor was going through with him and did say that there was something amazing had happened here, when it came to the crunch, he wouldn't put his name on the papers. So, they couldn't do anything about that. At the time, Father Paul Gardner was the postulator for the cause of Mary MacKillop. And he was on that show and I said, well, what are you going to do now, Father? And he said, I'm going out to look for the second miracle. Of course, he said, I think she is worthy of being our first saint, and I'm going to find it. It'll be out there. So Barry looked at me and he said, you know, ours was pretty good. I wonder why they didn't think of ours. I thought, I don't know, Barry. So he meld on that a bit, you know, really got to him. And the next day he rang the sisters up and he told them. So it was through, it was from 2005 that they took our case up again. What they said was that they'd lost them and would he get them done again and send them down? Exactly, that's just what he did, he laughed. I mean, Barry at the time wasn't a Catholic and I would never have been game to say that to a nun on the phone. But he was, and he said, oh, look, you lost the last lot. He said, I'll get them done again and I'll bring them down, but you have to look after them. Oh, amazing, isn't it? Anyway, that's what happened. So to be fair to the sisters of St. Joseph, they hadn't lost the files. One of the things the church states is that the person who was well has to be well for 5 years. Well, I was only just been told a couple of weeks that my cancer had gone. So what had happened is they had to put that file, you know, on the side, and it got put in the archives, actually. And so and they have been found since. So, so that was... I think it's... I think everything, even though we've had... we had a lot of criticism at the time of the canonisation, a lot on the internet and stuff like that. But I think what happened was it happened in God's time. It didn't happen in our time. It happened when it meant to happen, even though it could have been 6 years beforehand. So, yeah. So any questions any time, please. Yes. God love you.
Obviously, Kath, your doctor did his name to it.
Yes. There's a lovely story with my doctor.
Oh, I was going to ask you, is he a man of faith or did it change his view about faith?
I don't know whether it changed him at all, but what happened was he wanted me in the December and I went back in the April. In December he wanted me to go back and have the test done. He said, you should be dead. He called me his dead woman walking. And he said, you shouldn't be here. I'd love to know what was happening to your body. Will you go back and have a test done? Well, by this time I was back doing a few things and you know, I could get out and stuff like that. I never took back vacuuming or anything like that. But, you know, I only took back what I wanted to take back.
Still.
So I wasn't ready and I said, look, I really don't know. And he said, well, it could be just laying dormant. He said, cancer, you know, there's still, even 21 years later, they still don't know everything about cancer. So he said, it could lay dormant. It could have moved to another part in your body. And if it has, he said, it will show again. And once it does, you'll go very quickly. Or he said, it could have shrunk. Well, I didn't want to know any of those things because I was starting to feel a little bit better. So I said, no, I didn't want to go back. And it was in April that we had it was a weekend with Antioch. Antioch played a very, very big part in my journey. And we had an Antioch weekend, and it was that weekend at Reconciliation on the Saturday night that I got the message that it was time to go back and have tests done. So I went back to him and I said, I'm ready, I'll go and have tests done. So he said to Barry, wait for the x-rays and bring them straight back to me. So we did that, and when we came back, the doctor had already rung Barry, so he knew, rung the doctor, so he was waiting for us with a big grin on his face. And he said, this doesn't surprise me at all. And because we were flabbergasted, and we said, why? And he said, because every time I went out and saw you in my surgery, I say, Mary MacKillop, you want another miracle, take this one. And I didn't even know he was a Catholic. And so, you know, in his way, he was also asking Mary MacKillop. I thought that was very interesting, yeah. So he was the first one to say to us, if you want to approach the church, not for Mary MacKillop so much, if you want to approach the church and to see if they will declare this a miracle, I would stand by you. So he was the only one. Barry wrote to all the specialists that I'd went to. I only ever went to them once. But everyone that I went to, and he only got one reply back, and that was just two lines saying, I'm glad your wife is well. So no one was interested. But that wonderful doctor. Any more?
Kath, mine isn't a question. Hmm? Just I feel close to you, having said that beautiful prayer. It's my favourite prayer.
Yes.
And I carry copies of it in my car, due to lots of people.
Yes.
And I recommend it. It's such a down-to-earth prayer. And I happen to have shaky hands, so it's very relevant.
That's fine. It's a very comforting prayer, isn't it? That's what I call it, the comforting prayer. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that. Any more?
What did you find the biggest challenge was after the cure? I mean, I've read your book, and you talk about how the change of mindset from only having to plan 6 months to suddenly having all of your life back. What was the biggest aspect of that for you?
Yes. When I was first told that the cancer had gone, we were delighted, you know, coming out of the surgery, throwing my hands up in the air, and it was at Belmont, opposite the courthouse, and all these young people were waiting for a court for outside, and here's this mad woman, just, oh, thank you, God, thank you, Mary McKillop, and Barry's trying to drag me in the car. So he doesn't like being, you know, made a fool of. So we were very delighted. We were very thankful. And we were all that. But within, our house was full of people all that 10 months. There, and I really mean full of people. We had, you know, it was a florist shop. There was cards everywhere. There was flowers everywhere. And we did an Australian story, and actually Annette and one of my other daughters, our other daughters, said on that show, our house was always full and we used to have to make arrangements to see our mum. And we were usually the last to see her. So that was true. It was just like... No, it was like, yes, it was like stories you read in the Bible. It was an amazing story. And people used to come to our place that we didn't even know, just to see this woman who was happy because she was dying. You know, it was just an amazing time. But after I got better, wow, no one. No one. And after a few weeks, I thought I was going down in depression. I went back to the doctors and said, look, this is happening to me. And he said, you'll have to go and see your priest. He said, you're really not depressed. So I went back, and by this time our priest had left, and we had this young priest who was knee-high to a grasshopper, and he said to me, welcome back to Earth with us. And I looked at him and I thought, you little whippersnapper, here's me, I'm old enough to be your grandmother. And he's telling me that, wake up to yourself. But he was right, because I had learned to die. Then I had to turn around and I had to learn to live again. And they weren't easy times. So, you know, it's good to be able to tell you the story, but it does involve a lot of things, you know. Is there any other questions?
Just a bit of a follow-on from that. You mentioned, obviously, the wonderful story of how you recovered physically, and you were saying that sort of led to a time where you had to learn to live again. I'm curious as to how your faith sort of played into that and played into healing you emotionally from that stage and learning to live again.
Yes. People ask me a similar question of, did this improve my faith? Like, did I, you know, and that's what you're getting at,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah.
No, it didn't. In my 30s, I had a broken marriage, and my first husband left me with 4 children. And I was brought up in a very, very strict Catholic household. My mum was a nun before she was married, and my dad was training to be a Mara's brother. And so you can imagine the strictness in that house. And it was, you know, I was in my 30s. So back then it was fire and brimstone. And a lot of older ones here tonight can probably vouch for that. If you didn't go to Mass on Sunday, it was a mortal sin. If you ate meat on Friday, out the back door. You know, we lived on what we were told on Sunday. Now, these days, we question and we have to take the responsibility on board ourselves. But back then you didn't. It was much easier for me to turn my back and leave the church. And so I was away from the church for 10 years. Now, in that 10 years, and it was very, very early in that 10 years, I'd realised what I had thrown away. I was born into this faith, and I didn't realise how big a part of my life my church was. And that happens a lot, that you don't know what you got until you haven't got it. And I didn't know how to get back. It was me who turned around and walked away. So this me didn't know how to turn around and get back there. So I was away for 10 years. The good thing that happened in that 10 years is I met Barry and we had another child, Luke. Did you think you were getting left out, did you? Now, Luke, when he went to school, he went to a state school because we had shifted and it's a big, long story. The bus took him, you know, this little kindergarten kid, right to his door. So he went to a state school and he was making his first Holy Communion and he was getting taught the... whatever they get taught for the communion. help me. Yes, that wasn't the word I was looking for. It was Sister Cabrini. Does anyone know Sister Cabrini? What a darling she is. Well, she was Luke's RE teacher at the state school. And she took a liking to Luke and she said, did you have that?
Scripture,
that's the word. And she took a liking to Luke and she said, you know, you'd be good at a Catholic school. So he comes home and nags us, I want to go to a Catholic school. We said, okay, you can. We put him in Belmont. And then he wanted to go to Mass. Now, Barry wasn't a Catholic, so who had to take him to Mass? Me. And it was a devastating time for me every Sunday taking him to Mass. He loved it. But me, it was so upsetting. And so it was through Luke and Barry that I actually come back to the church. Now, this is it really answering your question. But by the time I was very fortunate to get a very, very understanding priest who I could go to and talk to. And he's very sick now. As Father Peter Brock, and he was the one who nurtured me and brought me back to the faith. Now, when I came back to the church, I found this loving Jesus that wasn't around when I was there before. It was always do this, do that. But we had Bible classes. That was something that was never heard of, was it? Bible classes, so I went along to them, and that's where I found this loving Jesus, and Jesus has walked with me ever since. So that was my conversion back when I was in my 30s, and so by the time I was sick with cancer, I have a very, very strong and beautiful relationship with Jesus that I still have today. So it didn't improve my faith. It didn't make me run out and it was beautiful and it still is. Yes?
Can I ask you, when your case was taken up as a candidacy for that second miracle, did the postulate who was going through it
The church scrutinises it very, very much so. What happened was that after they took up my case, their first thing job is to send just a data sheet over to Rome. And it just had every doctor I went to and just a very small, like, couldn't help or whatever. It was just on one sheet of paper. And the powers that be in Rome said, this is good enough for us to look at. So after that, they sent that back to the sisters. And after that, we had a big tribunal in Newcastle. And it was very, very hush-hush. Nobody was allowed to know that this was happening here in our very diocese at Hamilton. And to have that, I don't know if you know about tribunals, they're like a court case. And we had to have an outside bishop reside over that tribunal. We had the retired bishop from Sydney, Jeff Robinson, and we had to have an independent doctor. We had a priest, an independent priest, flown up from Victoria. So we had all these outsiders had to be at the tribunal. And we had to have 13 witnesses of people who journeyed with me, and also my doctor and my priest. And so it was a really, really big concern. And that was very, very... that was hard for me because all the others that went in, they had written a testimony of what they knew, and they were just had to go in and they'd read it out to them and they'd have to swear that it was right, you know. But with me, they put me through the third degree, yeah. So that was before it even went to Rome. It had to be passed by, you know, a group here in Australia. And when they did that, then Rome took up the case. It took 5 years.
Kath, would you share with us your involvement at the canonisation and how it felt to you?
Okay. Really, it's only 8:10. Yeah. Okay. This is me walking up. I was offered to either take the relic or have communion from the Pope. Communion from the Pope would have been much, much easier, I can tell you. But this was very nerve-wracking, as you can imagine. But on my right side is Sister Nisha, and she was the sister in Panola in South Australia, which was the first place that the first Josephite school started. And she was the sister at the time down there. Nisha now is in Sydney, but she was the principal at Panola. The one on my left is Ronnie Campbell, and he was flown out from Scotland, and he's the oldest living recorded relative of Mary MacKillop. Now, Mary MacKillop was the eldest of 8 children, and none of those children got married. None of them at all. So there was no children from that set of MacKillops. So he would have been a cousin, and he probably would have been a third cousin. And that's about the closest you can get to Mary MacKillop. Okay. So that was us taking up our little goodie bags. Ronnie Campbell, there's a lovely story with Ronnie Campbell. He brought this heather out from Scotland. He wanted the Pope to get heather, and he wasn't allowed to give it to the Pope because they all were given the same bunch of flowers. There was 8 canonised that day, and they were all given the same lot of flowers to give to the Pope for security reasons. The trouble is they didn't confiscate his heather. So Nisha and I stood around and we picked off the heather and we stuck it in the bouquet of flowers. So the Pope got heather anyway. But I don't think the Pope took them home, but you know, but Ronnie was happy. So yeah, so that's a great story. That's a photo I'm showing you. The casing, which to our casing was the wooden cross
That's called a reliquary. That holds the relic. And that photo just shows you how beautiful all the reliquaries were. Now, I'm not downing them because they were magnificent. But I'm putting on that table just a bit of wood, just a wooden cross. And we were very fortunate to meet the man who made the cross. When he knew I went into schools and spoke to the children on Mary MacKillop, he gave us this. And this is one he'd been working on, which he called it his dud, because, you know, there's a lot of mistakes in it and a lot of flaws in it. But he said to show it to the children and tell them about it. Panola was very famous for redwood, the kind of wood this is. It's a hardwood and they made beautiful furniture with it. This is an old fence post. And that's where the wire goes through. And that cross there, you can see the bottom, there's also a hole. And that's where another piece of wire went through. So the relic was put in here, in this hole here. And so that beautiful relic started off just like this, just an old fence post. And the fence post was taken from the property that Mary MacKillop first went over to Panola to teach, to be governess to her uncle's three children. And it was taken from that property. Okay? So that's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. The next photo shows you the relic. And you, the church asked you to give a first-class relic. Now, that's a second-class relic because it was taken, the one I had, because it was taken from a bit of material from her wimple around her face. So, but you need a first-class miracle to give to the Pope. Now, I've been asked many, many times, because some of them are really, really, you know, even one that was that went through with Mary MacKillop was centuries ago. We had a couple of pieces of hair, Mary MacKillop's hair. That was the relic we gave the Pope. And what would you do if you didn't have a first-class relic? I don't know. So don't ask me that question. Okay? Some say they dig up bones. I don't know. But we were very fortunate to have a locket of Mary's hair in a little heart-shaped locket that was down in the museum. So that's what the Pope got from us. It was a great honour for me to carry up that relic. It was very nerve-wracking, and you looked out to a sea of faces. It was dreadful. Streets and streets and streets of people. But it was a great honour, and it was a great privilege for me. Okay? Now, what about some questions now? There's a lot that you can ask me now. Yep?
So when you first found out you were cancer free, did you, you yourself know instantly that it was a miracle through Mary MacKillop, or was there part of you that sort of questioned how is this possible? Or did you, in your own heart, did you know?
No, we didn't know. We never knew before. A lot of people say, was there a time in that 10 months when you got up and you felt as though, you know, your cancer had gone? No, never. But when we were told after those first tests that the cancer had gone, both Barry and I were in that room and we believed straight away.
I've got another question. So you mentioned before that Barry wasn't Catholic, so from you being cured, have you converted him?
Not from being cured, no. It was amazing. Barry went through the RCIA and he came into the church in the Easter of 1994.
Three.
And I was diagnosed in July. So he had been in the church just a couple of months before I was diagnosed. 2005 is when we started. Yes. Oh no, he just corrected me. Thank you, little Barry. I haven't done this for a couple of months. I've been off.
It's called penance, and that, you know, like I was only in the church about 2 months and she got sick, and I've had to pay for it ever since.
Anything else? Any other questions? Yep.
Surely there's people out there that say, how can miracles be possible? And, you know, there's probably an explanation, we just don't know about it. How do you usually answer those sort of skeptics?
Look, I just come and tell my story. I don't try and convert anybody. People can believe if they want to. And we had one great experience. I can't remember where we were, but after it was over, before it was over in question time, this man put his hand up and he was a doctor. And he said, I've come here today as a skeptic and I wanted to pull you down. Because he said, I've heard a lot of people say they've had miracles and stuff like that. But he said, the way you explain how your cancer, and it must have been a day that I really explained where the cancer started, how it was, you know, everything that happened, what kind it was a non-small carcinoma cell, and all this, he said, that is just how what the cancer is. And then it went to the brain, and he said, by the time you finish talking about your medical part of your story, he was convinced. So that was really lovely to us. But that's the only one that I've had at my talks. We've had a lot of critics on, you know, we've had the head critic of Australia, haven't we, talk on computer, you know, writing on a computer. But, a lot of that stuff my family kept away from me because I'm not really a computer literate.
Just another question. Did you meet the recipient of the first miracle?
No, I haven't met her. I've talked to her on the phone, and we will meet one day, but she doesn't want to become anything public. So we're so busy now that we just haven't got time to sit down and work on that. But yes, you know, we've talked a couple of times, but it's, you know, it will happen, but we haven't.
It might be in heaven, no.
Might be, yeah. And she had the, you know, I never wanted to do this, as you can tell by my talking, I'm no professional, but, She was very fortunate to be the first miracle that only made Mary McKellar blessed. We would have liked not to have gone any further once the canonisation was on too. But there were so many critics, like, why won't this woman come out? What has she got to hide? And then they were on with the sisters in Sydney, you know, you trying to put her into a cocoon so you get all the glory. I mean, what glory is this? And so in the end, you know, it was we knew that we had to come out some way. Yeah. The only thing is, one of the things, that we have been offered hundreds of thousands of dollars to, in the beginning, from every magazine and every TV show to buy our story. And we said no, that wasn't what it was about. We realise now that we were led into saying no because we couldn't do this. They own you and you can only speak to who they want you to speak to. And we found that out. Women's Weekly came down to Kincumber where we lived and did a program on us at the same time, because I wrote a book. And I think I've got it here somewhere. I think I saw it. So, that's the book. And I wrote this, and to write this, I had to sign that I'd do some publicity. So the Women's Weekly come down, and they wanted a story, and the Australian story. Now, they were doing it the same week. But the Women's Weekly got in touch with me first, you know. And so then they rang up, they'd heard that through the week I was doing the Australian story, and they said, well, you can't. And I said, why? And they said, well, we got you first. There's no money passed over, nothing signed. We did it because we were told by Penguin that we had to do some publicity. And they were ready to pull a pin. They said, well, we're not going to write your story in Women's Weekly. And I said, good. Because it was a lot of, it was nothing to us. And it was a big day when we had down in Kincumber, wasn't it? When we were had all these cameras in our face. And, and that was no money involved. And they wanted to dictate to you. What would have happened if we sold our story? Oh, boy.
Be another Chappelle Corby.
That's true. We might have a big house to live in, but that would be it.
You wouldn't be happy now. You're happy
doing this. Yeah. So.
What motivates you in doing this, coming here tonight? What do you hope that we take away from this experience and share with you?
What I'd like this group, especially being a young group, is to cling on to hope. Also for you to know that really, being young people, you have a life in front of you and you can do whatever you want to do. You put your mind to it and you have the scope to do whatever you want to do. And with along with that, you have a prayer life that will help you do whatever you want to do. And that's what I hope that young people get out of this, you know, that that there is a God there and there is somebody who you can ask to help. And now, when I go into schools, I say to them, especially high schools, that some of them work at McDonald's, and I say, well, you know, some of you got that job because your friends worked at McDonald's. And you ask, would you put in a good word for me? And you still got to do the work when you get there. But that's what we've got in Mary McKillop. Hey, Mary, will you pray with me for this? Will you pray with me for that? And we have that great treasure up there in heaven who's very close to the big boss. So, yes, a great role model she is for the young people.
There's another thing too with the skills that like promote motivation. You say, you know, like, I don't know if any of you are teachers, so I know about them, but to the kids that, you know, that we've always been taught that the saints were out there, you know, way out, and we've got this homegrown son, and say the kids, Mary McKillop is just like one of you. She sat in the classroom, and that in Australia, just normally Australian girl, and then she became a teacher, just like all teachers. And then what did she become? Became Australia's first saint. And like Kat said, she's here to close to us, and we can ask for her intercession that way. So it brings it down to earth, it brings God down to the kids instead of their way out there. And that's what you young people can achieve. It's a bit hard for us oldies at times, isn't it?
I have one more question, if you don't mind.
Yep.
You talked about 10 years when you left the church and didn't know how to come back again. It's doubtless to me that there's many more people now today that they are in that same situation. You haven't been fortunate enough to have a son who wants to go to a Catholic school or something to take that first step. Is there anything we can do it as a church to provide that first step to people who are just waiting for it?
I think as a church we have a lot to learn. And as I said before, I was very fortunate to have a very gentle priest help me along. We have many, many people come to us if I share that story and say, hey, I'm in that posse now and I'd love to come back. And my advice is to first and foremost is to find an understanding priest. Because we've still got a few out there that you know, aren't as understanding as what they could be. As a church, as young people, I think your ministry, even this here tonight, is helping other people, you know. I met a woman who was doing, who was a catechist at a public school, and she was sick of it. She said, "I think this is rubbish." She said, "I'm not getting through to any of them." And I said, "Don't give up, because you don't know what seed you plant. And you, as young people, doing this here tonight, you don't know if there's someone going to walk up those steps and just listen to something here. And that's the seed that you've planted because the team has put this together." So I think that what you're doing now and being open and encouraging to people, and if anyone comes to you, to be sympathetic and listen. You know, a lot of times we won't sit down and listen to people, because unless you've walked in their shoes, you don't know what they've been through. So, yeah, you're doing a good job.
Adam works at a school down the, a college down the Central Coast, and in March last year, the young year 12 student was in an accident. Her car hit, she was with some other students, night time, and her car hit a telegraph pole, which was in a critical condition and wasn't expected to live. And this is March last year. She's still alive today. The principal from the school took two busloads of young, well, I think year 8 kids, so it's down to Mary McPhillip Place, and they prayed at Mary's tomb. And Kath and I were down there at the time, and he asked us, would we pray for young Lauren? And so we prayed, and we were way up in at Easter last year when we were up in the Rockhampton Diocese, and we got a message to say that she'd come out of the coma. She wasn't expected to live, and that she'd come out of it. She's still not very good with her brain, but she's improving. She's been to the school a few times, but she wasn't expected to live. And through the prayers and the intercession of Mary McPhillip, and that they've got their own little miracle, that big miracle down there, and it's happening everywhere. We hear of it all the time, probably because we're close to the sisters, and we're hearing about all these miracles that other people aren't hearing about, but they're around us all the time.
Thank you. Is that it? No, yep.
This is a tough one, maybe. Why is it that God hears some prayers and not others?
Well, I'm not in God's mind. I can't tell you how God works because I don't know. The miracles that you read in the Bible were all done for a purpose. They were to glorify God in some way. My miracle's no different. By going around and sharing our story is glorifying God in this day and age. Why some are picked and some aren't, I have no idea. Didn't help you much, did it? But you know, when you think of it, Jesus didn't go around and cure everyone. He only cured the ones to give God the glory. And as Barry said, there's a lot of miracles that people don't know, that they're as good as mine. Well, nearly, not quite. No, but you know, I think before this happened, I wouldn't even stand up in church and read. So Mary McKillop made me very bold, because the more I read and study Mary McKillop, the more I realised how bold she was, you know. She was, she had a terrible childhood, and she was, she believed in the things she did believe, she'd put herself out there. And that's, and she has made me strong to do the same thing, because this isn't my thing. I turned 70 last November, and they asked me for speech at my party. I got up and I couldn't say a thing. So, you know, God's helped me, and Mary McKillop and God too has helped me to be able to do this. And we never advertise. People ask us and we're willing to go. So it's, you know, we always say that it's God's work we're doing. It's not our story. Yeah. Thank you for all your questions. Yeah, pass with an A.
Are there any more questions? Oh, he's got one more. Come on.
I've got a question for your daughter, if that's okay.
Yep. I'm saying yes.
I just wanted to ask what was it like for you being the daughter of, your mother who was involved, or part of the reason why Rickard was canonised? How did you find it, knowing that your mother was going to die and then all of a sudden having her life back?
I don't really know. Like, it's because we were there, we had to live it, so it was just a belief. Like, we just believed. I never had any doubt. Like, before it all happened, yeah, we just thought she was going to die, and then all of a sudden she was still there. I was actually cranky with her because she had planned her funeral and wanted me to do things at the funeral, which I knew I wouldn't be able to do. And when she finally told me that's what she was going to get me to do, I said, how dare you? Tell me that I could do that at your funeral. I tell you what, I'm not that strong. But she said, I know you are. And I would have been able to do it. But, yeah, she's made me cranky because she had things set for me to do when she actually died. But I hadn't actually thought that far ahead, I guess, that she was only going to get taken from us, you know, because she was there, still there. It never happened.
It's just, you know, the question before and about God answering some people's prayers and not others. I think you'll find that he answers prayers in a different way. You know, to some people they get what they're asking for, and to others, like, you see a lot of people that are dying, that are cranky. We had a very good friend that was a dead-set atheist, and he was just so the cat, you don't believe in all that crap, you know, and when he was dying, and he got Kath to come up and talk to him, and then one day he asked her to talk to him about Jesus, and she used to go up every week and talk to him, and she bought him a Bible, and he died, this dead-set atheist, died the happiest anyone's seen, and his family were shocked, and so God works in different ways. He answers your prayers in different ways. It could be through giving peace to your family, or
Any more questions before we finish? Well, on behalf of the Diocesan Council that is putting Pints with Purpose on for all of you this evening, I'd like to give this to you on behalf of all of us here, to thank you for coming and spending what is obviously a fantastic and powerful, moving night with us, and sharing so much of your story. I've heard your story a couple of times now, but there were some things there that I haven't heard before, and they're definitely filling in the picture that the miracle didn't happen all the way back then, or did happen all the way back then, but I believe the miracle's still going on with your story and the way that you're able to tell it, and the grace of God moving through you, glorifying God
with your words and sharing your story with us. And of course, Barry, and of course, the Lord of Glories and Son, Barry, you know. So thank you very much on behalf of all.
Thank you.
Radio.org.au